All right, everybody, welcome to Space Force. I'm your host, Jason Tondro.
I'm Jim.
I am the reboot of Aid Smith.
And I'm the younger, sexier version of Professor McGee.
Aid, did you lose your parents in the reboot, like everybody else in this movie?
No, but it got a very complicated timeline. It's very, very different.
I live in France,
so I don't know what's going on with it. It's very, very odd.
So, for those of you that are listening, if you have not figured it out already, we are here to talk about Star Trek 2009. We are starting the last three episodes of this season of Space Force. We're going to take a little break maybe after this, but we're still talking about what to do next. Important Star Trek news, we just found out that Lower Decks is coming soon. In about a month, we're going to start getting our regular episodes of that cartoon. And you can bet that we will be talking about it here on the show. But in the meantime, I want to just, first of all, I'll take a few minutes to thank the rest of my cast. Because these films, these next three films, are not always the easiest films to watch. And some of us have pretty strong opinions about them. And I get that. So I want to thank my fellow teammates here, my bridge crew, for helping us all get through these next three films, which might be a bit of a chore. But hopefully, maybe we'll get some laughs out of it while we're at it. So Jim set us up a little bit here. Star Trek, this film comes out in 2009, I think.
Yep, 2009.
And Abrams, J.J. Abrams, who would later go on, of course, to do the Star Wars reboot, or sequels, the Star Wars movies. He gets picked to do this first film. And many people have accused J.J. Abrams of basically Star Wars-ifying Star Trek. But what is Star Trek like at this point, about 11 years ago now?
There's nothing.
There's nothing.
There's nothing. Okay.
That's beyond the Great Barrier. Okay. Yeah.
It's sarcasm. So what happens is 2005, Enterprise ends. The finale is lackluster. Fans of that show do clamor that season four was what the show should have been. I happen to be in that camp. It should have been all along.
They got four seasons.
They got four seasons and it was canceled. So they did the Journey to Babel episode, and it was like the lowest ranked Star Trek episode ever. It came out during like the NBA finals or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't follow sports, so it's some sort of like there was a sporting event and everyone wanted to watch that and no one tuned in, and the next week Paramount announces Enterprise is being canceled.
What season was the Andorian stuff?
The Andorian stuff is peppled throughout the show.
Because that was always sort of my favorite bits of that show.
Yeah.
It gets heavier in season four because apparently the plan in season five was that Jeffrey Combs' Andorian guy would become a regular member of the bridge crew.
Oh, that would have been cool.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. All
right. So.
So Star Trek is in a small place of dormancy. You got the books coming out from pocketbooks.
Oh, yeah.
A couple years later, IDW. He picks up the license for Star Trek comics, and I'm super excited. And I actually bump into like the editor at Bortles when Bortles used to be up in the Riverside.
Yeah,
apparently he was traveling, and I just nodded out for like fucking 15 minutes. And not just about Star Trek, but like other IDW books I was reading at the time.
Yeah,
and I'm like, oh my god, I just totally fanboyed out. Like I walked away. I was like, oh, that's not the way to make contacts with people.
Oh well.
I was excited.
I would have done the same thing.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that. So Star Trek goes in sort of a dormant period, and no one knows what to do. We haven't quite figured out, like, we're not in the golden age of the superhero movie yet. That's, you know, 2008 kicks that off of Iron Man, and you have the Dark Knight that year.
Yep.
So a lot of people come out of the woodwork and start pitching their versions of Star Trek. One of those people is Brian Zingle.
I'm X-Men.
Superman Returns and X-Men fame.
Yep.
And the infamy that's currently
coming
to light.
Yep.
Check for Vanity Fair for an expose on that. He comes out with a pitch, and he contacts the writer of the most recent Mission Impossible films, and they write a pitch called Star Trek Federation.
Okay.
And it's set...
The Star Trek Mission Impossible Venn diagram continues to cross over, which I did not expect.
Well, if you take a long view of the two franchises, they're constantly butting heads.
all the way back
to each other. Like in the original series, they'll constantly sort of like props from Mission Impossible show up in Star Trek, and Star Trek props show up in Mission Impossible.
We clearly need a Mr. Phelps Kirk crossover.
Are you down with that? Okay. And then you get like Paris and Spock.
Yeah,
that's where the money's at. So they write this pitch, and basically the pitch it boils down to is the Federation following the Dominion War. It's post Nemesis is stagnating.
Okay,
it's in the period of decline. They have like 20 star systems. The Ferengi are the major power of the Quadrant. They have monetized the Bajoran religion. So Bajor is a superpower.
Okay.
And in all of this mess, we have a Konk. We have an Alexander Konk, grandson of Captain Konk.
Wow.
Well, great-grandson, something like he's somehow related to that line. Yeah. And he decides the only way you can, you know, spark a rebirth of the Federation is outside of the Federation.
Okay.
So he quits Starfleet and takes the ship out, and that's the show.
You can't fight the fire from inside the house.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's an interesting pitch. It's if you want to know more about, like, because those are a plethora of Star Treks that weren't taken, yeah. And there was a YouTube video by Trexpertise called "The Trek Not Taken."
Oh, nice!
And it delves into this a lot more in more detail than I can give you here on the podcast. Okay.
And if you go to the Star Trek Wikipedia Memory Alpha, you can read the entire original pitch, and it's well worth your time, because honestly, it's kind of a toss-up between Star Trek Federation or Star Trek Final Frontier, the animated series, about which is my favorite unmade Star Trek thing of all time, which thing I would have actually liked to see get done. Because I think Federation had a lot of potential, and I think Final Frontier had a lot of potential.
Final Frontier had wonderful uniforms.
Yeah, like, I really
I'm a uniform snob. Like, that's like I'm always like, okay, what uniforms are we using, and how do they look? The Final Frontier was a cartoon show that was pitched to try to get younger audiences interested in Trek.
In the same time,
very heavy 9/11 metaphors. Mm-hmm. It's like terrorists attacked, send like both the Federation and the Romulans into a period of decline, and it would have been very, very interesting. I was very, very sorry that you didn't get made either.
Yeah. So those like these little brush files of interest, and you know, Pocket Books comes along, and you know, they're chugging along. There's a book every couple months.
Sure.
They create they had success with DS9 in the relaunch. They had a lot of money for that. So they do a relaunch of like Next Generation novels. And that's where you get Beverly and Picard finally committing.
I want to note, this is a good time for me to note. I've been sort of famous on this podcast so far as being the guy who's currently holding up the Picard Crusher flame. But I want to note that I didn't feel this way. They obviously had grown apart over the course of the series until All Good Things. Like in All Good Things, they're back together again. And that was basically like the Dark Knight Returns of Star Trek, right? Like it shows this future that now suddenly, because it's a hit, everybody has to try and work towards, right? So I was like, well, so that's where I got the whole idea that he must be with Crusher. I will note that Gates McFadden has gone on record this last week and said that she is coming back for Picard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I know that. I read that.
She is coming back. Yeah. Now, she didn't say it. She said basically what I just said. She says, like, well, clearly they do not have a relationship. They were seeing other people during the show. But she said it would be sure nice if they did that. We'll see. I think she said that would be lovely. But you know, she can't reveal anything. She may not know anything.
Yeah, those like CBS nipples outside of our house.
But she is gonna be there. She's coming back.
Well, that's, you know, those things I think that you can do with that without having to be a couple.
I hate to do this, but you know, I mean, as much as I would like to not talk about the Abrams films, we're getting awfully deep in the Picard weeds.
Yeah, we are. We are.
That's true. So you know, they start coming out with books, and we don't hear anything about Trek. And then J.J. Abrams, this is like coming off of Cloverfield for him. Like he's the little reveal teases. Like he just sends a darkened picture of corridors.
Yeah.
And it was the corridors of the Kelvin. Okay. But, you know, we no even comment that it was a Star Trek thing. And people are looking at it and like, wait, those geometric shapes look like the classic original series. Like, what's going on? And then we saw it getting more triculations. And then, like, the first live footage we had of the movie is that teaser trailer of the engineer building the Enterprise. You guys remember this?
I don't think so.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it has, like, JFK's narration about going to the moon and space travel. And it's you just see sparks in the darkness. And then it pans up, and there's a welder, and he takes off his goggles, and then he looks up, and there's a silhouette of the Enterprise.
Okay.
Even more deconstructed than it is in the movie.
Right, right.
And that was the thing. That was, like, the 30-second teaser.
I see.
And even talking about it, I'm getting kind of goosebumpy, because that was, like, all the potential in the world. Like, Star Trek is going to have a budget.
Yeah.
which is a refreshing change of pace.
Yeah.
From after, you know, watching some of those TNG movies.
Yeah.
The movie comes out. It does big business. And already when the movie comes out, we'll stop at the sequel. There's a writer strike that happens. And then there's, like, a full-year lull before we get that sequel.
Which is Into Darkness.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, so one of the the film comes out, it does big dollars, and that's kind of just briefly touching on the whole reason why I think that we're kind of doing these films when we could have easily hit the abort button and parachuted out, is because a lot of people, including some folks who write or watch the show, this is kind of the Star Trek that they grew up with. Like this, when they were 12 or whatever, or 20, when they watched this show and when they watched this film, and it established the characters of Kirk and Spock. And they knew that Shatner and Nimoy played those characters before, but they didn't grow up watching those shows like Chris and I did, or watching TNG like you guys did. And this sort of established those characters, and it's a very modern film in the sense that it's a very 2009 kind of movie, you know, like.
Well, Jason, yeah. My friend.
Yeah.
If I may, I would like to respectfully disagree with your premise.
Okay, go ahead.
Now, I realize fully that the most dangerous thing in the world, other than saying my Twitter feed is the real world, the most dangerous thing you can say is my particular life experiences are all of reality.
Sure.
But after I'm going to be starting my 20, well, maybe possibly starting my 26th year in the classroom. I'm yeah. looking more like my 20, look like this one may be online, but wandering away. I spent 25 years hanging around the target age for these films.
Sure.
And when I first walked into a classroom in 1995, you could drop a Star Trek reference in any class that I had from like basic level to advanced, and people would get it.
Yeah, beam me up, Scotty.
Yes, yes. But as time went on, you know, students stopped coming up to me after class and asking me what my favorite episode was, and if I was more of a Kirk or Picard guy. Yeah. I always made them smile by saying Cisco. But you know, and then nothing. I'd mention Kirk and Spock get blank stares.
Yeah. Okay.
There was about a month. When this movie came out, there were some of my students were saying, hey, yeah, there's this big new movie Star Trek coming out. You want to go see it? Maybe.
Right.
And then it came out, and I've not heard a blessed word about it since.
Yeah.
It's just another big budget movie that fell down the memory hole along with, you know, Big Mama's House and the third Teenage Mutant Ninja reboot.
Yeah.
Now listen. But so from what I can tell from 25 years in the classroom, the only reason this film is staying alive is for people that love the original show and absolutely fucking hate every atom of it.
Okay. Well, so tell us why this movie is like a Turkish picture.
Well, okay. I wanted to start off with something nice. And you know, for a major, for a, ma- for a major studio looking to get paid, they made a lot of right decisions about this thing. I think as much as I love Federation and Final Frontier and those other ideas that we were just discussing a second ago, really the right thing to do was to go back to the original, update it, and just streamline it. And, you know, and trim off some of the barnacles, you know, make this the Crisis on Infinite Earths of Star Trek. So I think they had the fundamentals down pat. But they screwed. But then they made the most unfortunate error. They handed the keys of this franchise to the second worst major filmmaker working today, J.J. Abrams, a guy who has one plot.
Now everybody in the audience is asking who is the number one worst. So you have to fill that in.
Well, that would be Zack Snyder. Because if you're in a social situation where you've got the drizzling shits and you can't tell your friends you got the drizzling shits, just run to the bathroom, start yelling, "Release the Snyder Cut!" and everybody will know what your particular malady is.
Okay, back to Abrams.
Yes, yes, and the end result we.
Oh, you cut out.
With like why this just fundamentally doesn't work. Other than the fact that J.J. Abrams is a terrible filmmaker. One of the most beloved nights of the movies I've ever had was my good friend, longtime friend, Hal Mangle, and I went to our local Alamo Draft House to see a Turkish kung fu movie. And it was even better than the basic idea of Turkish kung fu movie is. You're imagining.
Yeah.
And we saw about a half hour of Turkish movie trailers before that. And the great thing about Turkish movies is everybody thinks they're just that they're just these cheap ripoffs. But the thing about Turkish films is they are cheap ripoffs, but they're cheap ripoffs made by people that apparently have not actually seen the films they're ripping off. They're basing it off of something they heard like second or third hand. Sure. Like Turkish E.T. is an alcoholic.
Okay.
You know, a Turkish Rocky is apparently also Turkish Rambo, because why not? I mean, they're pretty much the same film, right? Why not combine them?
Yeah.
You know, Turkish Mad Max is about his unkillable sidekick, you know? Yes. So at that moment, it coalesced for me. This is basically Turkish Star Trek.
Okay.
This is Star Trek made by somebody who's never actually seen the original, but has kind of heard of Dr. Spock a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
Because and for me, I give you one final example, and then I will let other people, you know, take their turn at the knife. Okay. So one of the reasons I love the original series is I've always really, really, really liked Captain Kirk.
Yeah.
Because here's a guy who is not a perfect human being, but manages to flourish in a position of great responsibility. He knows poetry, or at least enough to sound impressive. Yeah. You know, he's a big history nut. And yeah, and he's good in a fight, and he's got a way with the ladies.
Sure.
And this deep, rich character that actually exists in the show over the years, after 50 years of stand-up comics, he's been reduced to this arrogant, overacting horn dog.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the version of Kirk that we get in this movie isn't anything like the very, very rich and well-developed characterization that we got from Shatner and the creative people. We get the stand-up comic where he's like, oh, Kirk just wants to have sex all the time, and he doesn't actually know what he's doing. He's just this big idiot who gets by bullying people. So yeah, I mean, this is Turkish Star Trek. It's Star Trek made by people that have only heard third or fourth hand anything about the original.
That
to me is why it fundamentally just doesn't work.
Yeah, the observation about Kirk is interesting, because as I was watching the film, I was really struck by all the times that other people, like Pike, for example, or McCoy, are telling us how great Kirk is. And how he needs to be put in charge, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the character himself, of course, never convinces us of that. We're supposed to just buy it, because that's what Pike says. And who's the actor that plays Pike?
Bruce Greenwood.
Yeah, he's great. Like, he's got that sort of authoritative air to him, you know, and he's very matter of fact, he's an overactor, chew the scenery. And so when he...
Well, him and Hemsworth are two of the rare people that just don't completely and utterly fucking embarrass themselves in this movie. I'll give him that.
Yeah. And so when he says, like, well, you know, your scores are off the charts or whatever. I mean, it's stupid that the audience has to tell us Kirk is smart.
Well, that's J.J. Abrams for you. Yeah. It's tell and show, and neither one's very good.
All right, Abe. You've been very patient here. When we
that's all good.
Let's start with the casting because that's kind of the obvious thing, and Chris has already kind of got us there with Chris Pine as Kirk. What'd you think of this? Like, there was a big deal about Quinto taking over the role of Spock, and he and Nimoy, you know, on the set and working together. And Quinto's been very open about his admiration for Nimoy and after Nimoy's death and so on. What'd you think?
I actually like all of them. I honestly cannot think there's, out of the core crew, as it were,
yeah,
there's no one. Okay, they're different, right? Yeah, we get that. But once you kind of accept the fact this is Kirk, this is Spock, then you kind of just settle in. But I think they play good. Carl Urban's McCoy. I like Carl Urban's McCoy. I used to like McCoy in the original series. I do like him in this one. Uhura, I think, is really good.
Yeah.
I think she plays it very, very well. And yeah, I just think they're a good cast. I really do. I say you get this a lot though, where you get a decent cast and then unfortunately the storyline suffers or something else trips them up. But even this, I mean, I've watched it yesterday again. I've not seen it for a while again. I actually thought it was pretty damn good.
You know, I love Carl Urban. Like he can basically be in any movie and I will watch it. But this struck me as another example of something we've been talking about previously that I have been talking about previously, which is when the technical aspects of the film, the set design, the costumes, the music, all of that stuff is let down by the writing. Mm. And this seemed to be another example of that. We have a couple of folks, by the way, that have joined the show, Dale and Yogi Donnie. Should we call you Donnie? who makes a note of saying, and Chris, I'm sorry, you always say that some Star Trek movie is someone's favorite Star Trek movie. This is my favorite Star Trek movie.
Again, the thing is about this is, like you say, the costumes are very nice, right? For starters, right? The Kelvin costumes are very reminiscent of Discovery and Enterprise, okay? They are different looking than the ones we get in the Kirk era. So they've actually made an actual choice. Rather than saying, oh, well, chuck them in the same old stuff, nobody will give a crap. There's a 25-year gap in it. That's very cool. The new costumes have got at least a nod to the original classic costumes. Okay, they've got the HD texturing that we all have and everything nowadays because we can't have flat fabric. But they actually have the color coordination, which, again, looks really nice.
Yeah.
The as I've mentioned on the notes, the actual set design of the bridge, love it, fantastic. Way too many lights, of course.
Yeah, too many lights, yeah.
Way too many lights. Probably a little bit too white as well. The actual, it would be nice some extra colorization in it, and rather than just, you know, this kind of, yeah, it reminds me of the ship from the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movie, where the Heart of Gold, where it's all completely white as well. right. But the actual design of it looks like the Enterprise. I like it. It's very cool. But it's engineering that annoys me more than anything else. Engineering bugs the crap out of me.
Like these tubes with water everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, how is that?
Because I'd heard the reason was because they ran out of budget because of the actual bridge stuff, and they filmed the engineering in like a water refinery.
I find it hard to believe this movie ran out of money.
No, but it just looks terrible compared to, I mean, considering like the warp core, we don't even see like a decent warp core set that we've seen on every other single film. There's not that thing where they all go around and, you know, all the, you know, the safety stuff drops down. It's always, it just looks like a weird, yeah, it looks like a sewage works. It's just so strange.
Jim?
Well, sewage works, that's pretty fairly appropriate for this film. Sorry, Jim.
Oh, it's all right. So to Yogi Donnie's point, I'm going to play devil's advocate to Chris.
Okay, good.
Not intentionally. So I kind of, after seeing, you know, we sat through all these movies, right? We sat through the movies, we sat through one whole season. We've done a lot of Trek. One of the things that we keep asking is, you know, what is Star Trek? And what is Star Trek to me?
Yeah, good. Yes.
What is my relation to Trek?
Yeah.
And I think I'm coming on the side of being a big tent Trekkie.
A what? A big tent Trekkie. Okay.
Yes. So will all sort of iterations of Star Trek, like Star Trek is kind of like Superman.
Okay.
Every 10 years or so, DC Comics publishes the new origin of Superman.
Right.
And it's not because they don't, they're disrespecting the old origin. They just want to have a new mission statement for the character.
And I want to note that that worked on me. Like, I had not read Superman. And then when Byrne got headhunted and came over to write Superman, I was like, okay. So I started to read it. And it worked. It got a new audience.
Well, but yeah, well, they do have in common the fact that it was a much needed stripping away of the barnacles by the guy who was at the time a talented creator.
Right.
As I said at the beginning, my only fundamental problem with rebooting Trek was that why do you have to bring it back with an asshole and the rest of them are just idiots.
Yeah. Okay.
And by the way, just one we would be remiss with just not talking about how just fucking loud this film is. It seems like every line is shouted at you. Everything's too bright. Everything's too big. You know, it's like if there was a legitimate attempt at a dramatic or moving moment in this film, you'd never notice it because this film is holding you down and pummeling you with its budget. I've sat through Robot Monster. I've sat through The Room. I've sat through all three Birdemic movies, and this is the only film I ever felt like was physically assaulting me.
And that's the direction, right?
Yeah, more than anything else. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Because again, there's some really nice bits. The opening stuff with the Kelvin and the space teens and like the silence of space and all that kind of stuff. That's kind of almost like reboot Battlestar Galactica coolness. I really like Battlestar Galactica. It's just the spectacle of it is really nice.
Yeah.
And again, we've got stuff because we've got the CGI stuff. We can do so much more with space battles now that we couldn't do with models. You just have to fly it down a string, So it looks really cool. The thing that I like about this film more than anything else is it's a reboot, but it's a reboot still tied to the original continuity. That's the best thing they did.
Yeah, so let's talk about that because I know, Chris, you had some thoughts on this too. And I have to say, I love that decision. I love the fact that they even – I kind of wish they wouldn't talk about it during the movie. But we'll get to my thought about how this movie is really kind of about itself later. But the fact that they left the original continuity of Star Trek completely intact, and it's not a retcon, it's not a reboot, it's an alternate version of Star Trek. And coming from a person who loves multiple versions of things, like I love to see multiple takes on all of these characters. I love that because that meant that I could still have the original characters and the window is open for future stories starring those characters, which of course we have now gotten 10 years later, right? And I was very pleased by it. I thought that was brilliant.
Well, I am as a fan of Star Trek, I'm with you because anything that allows me to cut off the Abramsverse like a gangrenous limb, I'm all in favor of.
Yeah, okay, good.
But the thing is, okay. The great thing about the great redeeming virtue of this whole idea was it was going to be a stripping away of the barnacles. It was going to be a Star Trek that people who want to get into Star Trek can follow. It was going to be a zero issue, if you will, if you're into comics.
Right.
And then your plot revolves around the fact about how now there's two complicated universes. Some people in this movie are from one, some are from the other.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it was just an unnecessary complication because I'm glad that we can just safely ignore the Abrams verse because of it.
Yeah. And that's something that occurred to me as I was watching the film. I was thinking about it after it was over. And Jim just referred to us. We're talking about the parallel universe plot line.
Yeah. I'm sorry. You went blank on me. I didn't realize we were both talking. Oh, okay. I had one last sentence, then I'm done.
Of course.
Okay, I think they've been way better off just following the wisdom of the Mystery Science Theater 3000's theme song. Do your own Kirk and Spock movie, and if people ask how it connects to the other one, just say to them, if you're wondering how he eats and breathes and other science facts, just repeat to yourself, it's just a show. I should really just relax. Just don't even go there. Just don't even go there.
Yeah, I love it. I love it because of that reason. I love it because they tied it to the original continuity. Because I think it gives starters, it gives people that seen the original stuff to actually kind of tie it to the original and give them another reason to do it. I mean, the idea that Len Nimoy was going to be in a new Star Trek film, I mean, that's the seller straight away. You go, oh my God, okay, that's great. So that's good news. So I like the idea they tied it to the original timeline, but and obviously the worst thing about it more than anything else is because we skip forward 25 years over the Kelvin being destroyed and Kirk, yep. There's no real sense of what's changed in those 25 years from the original timeline. So you just have to make it up. Obviously, we've got like an Orion gal. So are the Orions weren't part of the Federation? Are they part of the Federation now or not? I think it's just one single Orion. We obviously see that some technology has obviously probably changed, which is what they're saying about and obviously the Federation's mission statement seems to have changed as well, because they seem to say it's like they don't mention exploration when he says about the mission statement of the Federation. Now, whether or not that's to do with, hey, somewhere out there, there's a huge ship that's going to come smashing the hell out of some other places that we need to be up there ready to defend ourselves kind of thing. I don't know. But, I mean, at least that gives some reason for why they changed their mission statement. So, again, you can gloss over a lot of things by saying, okay, that makes sense. There's alternate universe. This is an alternate universe version, and it steers away from the other one. There's nothing more annoying when someone comes along and says, it's a reboot. Ignore everything else. It's a reboot. This is now, at least they say, hey, if you like the original stuff, there's still acknowledgement to that.
Now, Jim's had some tech problems. He's back with us now. Can you hear us?
Yep.
Okay. You were telling us about how, before we went off on this, on our opinions about the parallel universe split, about how you thought this film was like Superman. And I don't think we ever got to your point.
Well, no, I'm talking big picture. Like, Star Trek is Superman.
Yep.
Like, every few years, we reinvent what Star Trek means. Like, Next Generation is a reinvention of the classic Trek formula.
Yep.
The films are a reinvention of the classic Trek formula with more military themes and making it appropriate from a 60s TV show to the modern-day audience. DS9 is a reinterpretation of that, except instead of going places, we have to stay here and live with our consequences, you know, nation building and whatnot. Voyager takes the idea of we're all alone, that concept that was in the original series, and made it the whole premise of their show.
Yep.
And Enterprise made it like, we're humans, but we have feet of clay, and we're just taking our false nation steps. And 2009 Trek is the first time that there's a crisis that happens. Like, we've already thrown that out only on the podcast. There is this rebooted timeline. And then it's what parts of Trek do they keep and what parts of Trek do they leave behind? And how do they sort of jive with it? And I think that the thesis of the movie, Spock Prime says at the very end of the movie, when he tells himself, Spock, in this case, do yourself a favor, put aside logic, do what feels right.
Okay.
And it sort of feels like the whole movie is sort of based on people having to come to terms with their emotions.
Yeah.
And sort of like having emotional intelligence. Now, I can quibble about people being promoted up from not even graduating the academy to captain of the flagship. I can quibble about the fact that, okay, by your logic, well, 10 years earlier than Kirk's time because Pike hasn't taken the Enterprise out.
Yep.
And Chekhov is 17, even though the event that impacted Kirk's life has no impact on Chekhov, but he's 17 instead of being 7. Like, because those continuity gaps all over the place to get it to feeling right.
Yeah.
And I think he's sort of talking to the audience in a way. And like everything sort of buttresses and supports that idea of this feels right. Like, because Abrams movies aren't going to speak to the intelligence. He's not interested in that. He's interested in soliciting emotion from you. The first 10 minutes of this movie are great. And you care about Chris Hemsworth, you know, George Clooney. He's got the right name. He's got the right look.
Yep.
And you care about him, even though he's basically a red shirt.
Yeah.
He's a red shirt who dies. And his death signals, oh, this is a breakaway from that.
Right, right. You know, as I was thinking about this film, some of the things that you're just saying kind of dovetail with what I was thinking. Because I was trying to give my give the film the, and I'm not a fan of everything physically in the movie. I think that the new version of the Enterprise, it's like the sports car version of the ship, you know. And I'm not wild about it. I confess. But I said, okay, let's give this movie a chance and ask ourselves what I ask of a lot of manuscripts that I see, which is, what is it trying to say? What is this film trying to say? And I'm not saying that it succeeds, but what's it trying to say? And of course, the main plots are all about people losing their parents, right? It's about Spock losing his mother and Kirk losing his father, and about the effects of that on the individual. Like, how is Spock different now that he loses his mother? And how is Kirk's whole life different? How is he a different person because he never knew his father? And then it occurred to me, well, isn't that kind of the whole movie itself? That is, Star Trek 2009 is the child of the original series, you know? And it's kind of like, in that sense, the film is asking about itself. It's saying, how am I, as a movie, as a franchise, different because my parent is dead, right?
And, but here, sorry.
Well, the answer seems to be, I'm going to be really emotional about everything, right? That the answer is not flattering. The answer is, I'm gonna grow up without my parents, and as a result, I'm gonna be this kind of acting out, super emotional, as Chris was describing it while you were gone, Jim, like just incredibly loud, in your face, like everything is just cranked up. And that's the new version of me without parents. And Kirk embodies this. He's, you know, like you described, like Chris described him, and you're not wrong. He all he wants to do is race cars and fuck women. And it's like, Jesus Christ, right? Look, is this the guy who reads, you know, Tale of Two Cities and makes me cry at the end of Star Trek II? When not at the death scene, which I make it through usually, but when he looks at the camera and says, I feel young, like that. And the thing is that when I watched Chris Pine in Wonder Woman, for example, now I liked that film, and I thought Chris Pine did pretty good in there because he was funny. And this tells us why he was recruited for this movie. He wasn't recruited to be a serious actor who brings, you know, the shat. He was recruited to be comic relief. And I think that Chris Pine, like certain other action stars, like Chris Hemsworth, for example, quite frankly, would rather be funny than be action heroes. And when I see Chris Pine on the screen, he's never really serious. He's always kind of, even when he's trying to be serious, he's really just Kirk Swagger, you know? And so this film really struck me as kind of, you know, Kirk as an embodiment of the whole film, and the answer to its question, what do we turn into when we grow up without our parents, is kind of a adolescent sex fantasy that didn't really win me over. Let's put it like that. Now, but there were elements there, but what the film is trying to say ultimately was disappointing to me.
You know, I think you're being very, very kind and generous by suggesting that this film wanted to quote unquote say anything.
Yeah.
Because the elements that you talk about,
yeah,
it basically gets back to one of my main issues with J.J. Abrams. Every film has to be Star Wars. He doesn't want to say anything. Francis Ford Coppola wanted to say things. Orson Welles wanted to say things. J.J. Abrams wants to just keep remaking Star Wars over and over again.
Well,
and all this stuff about family, and you're being way more kind and generous to it than I ever would be. Conceit and failing of the Star Wars movies is that everything in this entire infinitely populated galaxy revolves around two families, or one or two families. So, I mean, I don't think it's an attempt to say anything as it is to, let's make it like Star Wars.
Well, I disagree, but I don't think that it's, but not as much as you'd think, because one of the things that I feel the Marvel films fall for this too, is that they gesture towards saying something. They make a head fake towards some big issue that they really don't actually grapple with. They just kind of parade it around like a way to make their film seem more serious. And I think I think that's kind of what's happening with the family issues in this. Like, Spock loses his mother, Kirk loses his father, and we're supposed to feel like this movie is saying something about parents and children. But ultimately, it's not really resolved. It's just kind of like, you know, the painted on top to kind of give the film a look of respectability to people like me who try to literally analyze everything.
The thing is, well, that this film does do, the other Trek stuff that doesn't do is you've got cast here that are known cast members. They're not just random people we've never heard of before. These are people who've seen the other film.
Okay? Yeah.
And this time we've got scenes where Uhura, when she says about getting the Klingon information and decoding that, shows some skill. We have the stuff where Chekhov probably does more in this film than he does in the other six in the original film, because he actually does something. He runs in the corridor, he does that, because he's actually got a skill that is useful to the thing. Sulu gets to fight on the side of a giant space drill. I mean, when did he get to do that in the original series?
Yeah, you're right.
They utilize, actually, it's funny enough, Carl Urban is probably the one guy that gets to do the least amount of stuff.
He gets
to run around following Kirk a lot. Whereas, like I said in the notes, if that would have been the original series stuff, on that space drill, it would have been Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. Guaranteed. It would have been no one else apart from those three.
Well, they would have brought Ensign Leibowitz or whatever.
And the fourth guy that you can burn up and die as soon as he lands. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. But they do tend to give everybody at least a scene or something where they say, okay, well, you're just not the guy just steering the ship. You're not just the guy pressing the photon torpedo buttons. You've got something else you can do outside of your normal little thing. Yeah.
Now, Jim, you have some thoughts about the casting and remaking of the Spock, McCoy, Kirk triangle.
Yeah. So, to Eight's point, McCoy does sort of walk around holding Kirk's, you know, holding Jim's back. Like, he's not part of the Trinity. Right now, with the reboot, the Trinity is Kirk, Spock, and Horn.
Yeah, and it's a romantic triangle. It's a love triangle.
Yeah, and in the original series, like, the cosmology of Star Trek in classic Trek is a balance between emotion, logic, and action, right? It's the Logos, Pathos, and Ethos.
Okay.
Trilogy, and they'll sort of embody. And the metaphor does break down in some episodes, but if you have too much emotion, you have Omega Glory. If you have too much logic, you have A Taste of Armageddon, right? You have these systems that, you know, Kirk beams into and is like, I'm going to rewrite your society because it's, you know, doesn't conform to how I view, you know, it's a colonialist view of Trek, right? And the person embodying Pathos now is Uhura. She emotionally reaches for Spock after the destruction of the planet. Right. And that's when we realize that they're in a romantic relationship. It's been teased. And then we see the kiss and the asking of what you want. And what that does is it shifts the power dynamic. Now Kirk isn't the one with agency. So, like, classic Trek setup, you encounter a new race. You have Spock have his points. You have McCoy talk his points. And then Kirk makes a decision. Now it's Spock who has the agency in the dynamic. Because he's being buttressed by Uhura, who is the one saying, you know, what do you need?
And Zachary Quinto is coming to this off of Heroes, the TV show, where he was the primary antagonist who became kind of an anti-hero over the course of the show. And that was his breakout role, and he was incredibly famous at the time for being, I can't remember the name of the character.
Cylon.
Cylon. and do you think that, like, is he the star?
I think he is. Like, I think he, like, because you have an old, you have Leonard Nimoy with the setup.
Yes.
So Spock has to be the major character. Yes, Kirk is the one who bullies him, to Chris's point. He bullies him to having an emotional reaction and losing control of the ship on the bridge, which gives him the chair. But the one who actually has a story arc, who has something set up that he is, like, they make fun of his mom. He beats up the guy.
Yeah.
You attack his mom, he's going to beat you up. Like, that's what this Spock is. Like, Spock loves his mom. Like, he's like, Martha's written all over Spock, right? Amanda, I guess.
Yeah, right.
Why didn't you say that name? You make fun of his mom, he's going to beat the crap out of you. And he's grappling. He's the only one who's given a character. Like, Kirk is the same way throughout the whole movie. His position changes.
Yes.
But he's fundamentally not changed from the guy who's on the motorcycle, who's getting beat up in balls, who keeps having the swivel head.
Okay.
If he's just waiting one more time, I'm just going to vomit.
I want to jump in here to point out, so we talked about how Kirk, we keep getting told that Kirk is such a great captain. But the one moment that we actually get a chance to see how great of a captain he could be before he becomes captain is the Kobayashi Maru. And I hate that sequence so much in this movie that it's filled with these sort of gratuitous Easter eggs, like the apple thing. The only reason why he's eating an apple is because he eats an apple when he talks about the Kobayashi Maru in Star Trek II. And that's just there just to like make the character seem like the people that know that recognize it. But to other people, it's like, what's up with the apple? Like it's so gratuitous and sustained. And then he doesn't treat it seriously. Like, this is such a lost writing opportunity because you could have put the character in there and he could have shown us that all of that bullshit about racing cars and chasing women was an act, that it was a defensive gesture that he does to keep people away from him because he's traumatized, right? And we could see what he's really like when he's got a real job to do. And he could earn our respect. But instead, they play the whole scene off for laughs, and it's just so goddamn disappointing.
Look, so here's
the thing, okay? To Abrams' Star Wars, his operating paradigm, is the same three or four notes over and over again, and Abrams' Star Wars movies are giving you those same three or four notes over again because, disappointingly, Abrams knows the Star Wars fan base. Single film, never really changing. They will accept whatever shit you want to put on screen. Story makes no sense, doesn't matter. Movie's 8 hours long, they don't give a damn. And to Abrams, his idea of Trek is, I guess people want to see that, to see the horny asshole captain bully people and be an idiot and get saved by the other slightly less idiotic crew members. You know, to Abrams, giving this character some layers or anything like that, it breaks away from the fact that I'm going to give you the same three or four notes that you want to see over and over again, just like in Star Wars, and you'll pay to see it. And well, at least for this one film, we race down to his extremely lowered expectations.
Now, I want to ask about Abrams is famous. I think he did a TED talk on this. We talked about the puzzle box or the mystery box?
Mystery box.
The mystery box. Jim, unpack the mystery box and how that plays out in this movie.
I hate the mystery box.
I know.
So in the TED Talk, he talks about how his uncle, because, you know, like Colt Kale and like Abrams doesn't know his dad. And so he has an uncle, a maternal uncle, that is sort of his father figure. Okay. And he was gifted a mystery box from like a magic shop. And it's just this box that stands about yay big. And it has a question mark on it. Nothing else on it. Just a question mark. There's some like Victorian style design works in the paper on the paper store. He doesn't know what's inside it. Okay. And that's how he approaches his stories. What's the mystery box? What's the unknown element that's going to reshape our understanding of the film? And he never delves into what's inside it. In A Force Awakens, it's more obvious that who's Rey's parents, right? Yeah. Rey comes from nowhere, that's the mystery box of Force Awakens. This film, I don't know if there is a mystery box.
Well, I don't think there is.
I know there's a mystery box in Into Darkness.
Hey,
Tron.
Aid, what's your theory?
Yes, so I don't think there is one. I can't think of one. I honestly cannot think of the question that's asked, what is going on, because it's all literally laid out. Nero wants to destroy Federation. Nero wants to. There's no kind of, where did this guy come from? What's going on? No, even kind of weird time travel-y stuff. It's literally beat for beat for beat. There's no mystery box as such. Yeah,
the characters don't understand what's going on, mm-hmm. but the audience does, in theory. we know that Nero shows up and he says, "Do you know who Ambassador Spock is?" And the captain of the Kelvin is confused. But in theory, we aren't.
I wonder if the audience that was told that this was going to be a brand new Star Trek that you didn't have to have seen any of the others to understand, yeah. we're sitting there along with him going like, what the hell? Yeah. Who yeah. are these people?
Yeah, see, this is the thing. The weird thing about that is the motivation for Nero is pretty weak, okay? It's like, hey, I'm gonna blame Spock for the exploding sun that destroyed my planet. It's like, what? Did he go and light it? What's going on? So the idea of that, it just seems a bit of a stretch straight away. And the idea, again, like, oh, I'll destroy Vulcan, and then I might as well have a crack at the Federation while they're here at the same time. There's another weird thing as well.
But I just want to know about. Oh, go ahead.
I was gonna say. I mean, I don't know if you want to talk about the Romulans in general at this point in time as well. Sure. So. The idea that obviously these Romulans are prime universe Romulans,
yeah,
because they follow in, they come in with Spock at the same time. So, but these Romulans act nothing like Romulans,
right?
They don't look like Romulans. They haven't got the ridges on the thing. They talk strange. Say, so literally the introduction to Pike is, oh, hi, Christopher. My name's Nero. Yeah. It just seems like that doesn't sound like any Romulan talking whatsoever.
Turkish Star Trek.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah,
and this is what Abrams' dependency on multimedia is a failing of his storytelling.
Because so, you're talking about comics and stuff.
Because yes, the Countdown comic, which establishes what the situation is and why Spock's to blame, is because he gives the Romulans false hope that he can solve this problem.
Yeah.
Right. And then sort of alluded to in the movie, but it's not in the text of the film, so we can't judge it as such.
And the fact that his ship has got Borg technology is also explained in the comics.
That's also exactly, yeah.
And the other point is these are supposed to be Romulan minors. They're the working class.
Yeah.
Like, that's why it's, oh, hello, Christopher. And it's so weird because we're like, we're used to Romulans with this sort of sense of, pomposity. And this guy's like, no, I'm going to crack open a bail and I'm going to sit in a prison for 25 years.
When I saw those scenes, I interpreted as kind of modern Hollywood's obsession with giving the audience what they don't expect. In other words, when a Romulan shows up or a big bad guy, you expect the big bad guy to be sort of pompous. And so we're going to make him be casual. Like whatever we think the audience wants, we're going to give them the exact opposite. On purpose.
Originally they said they're originally going to use the Klingons. And obviously, we've used the Klingons loads and loads and loads. Let's use something different. But obviously, off of Nemesis, we've just seen the Romulans. And they're so different from the other Prime Universe Romulans. The strange thing is, like you say, the ship they have in this is so much like the Scimitar in Nemesis, in that kind of vastly huge... It's like, where are they keeping these ships? It's like, they've got a couple of these stashed away somewhere. So,
Well, now, it's not like they're an empire with a notoriously efficient secret police that would catch all this stuff immediately. Come on.
It's true. But, I mean, that's what's so weird about it. Because it's like, again, the design is so non-Romulan. It seems to be like, hey, we'll just create this from scratch. What ship is it? Oh, chuck some Romulans on there. That'll be fine. They're Romulans now. There's no kind of aesthetics that shouts Romulan. Like I said in the notes, the idea that we saw them in their Romulan uniforms when they first arrive, and then 25 years later, they go for the cyberpunk look they kind of maintain. Well, at least kind of gives some idea that they've changed. They've adapted to this new life they've got in this universe. I mean, the other thing is, obviously, they could go to Romulus in the new universe because it hasn't been destroyed yet.
Yeah.
So they could have done something with that, but they didn't do that. They just hung around for 25 years, had a bit of a sit around, waiting for Spock to show up, and then literally just snatch him as soon as he arrives.
And, this is where the multimedia thing comes in, because they explain in the comic book, like, I hate having to say, well, in the comic, they explain X, but they explain that Neo is captured by the Klingons and he spends 25 years in Rorpente. Hence the line that there was a breakout of a Klingon prison, but you're so distracted to pick up on that line because Uhura is undressing.
Yeah.
And Kulk's not interested in the information. He's interested in checking out Uhura.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, that line, apart from the idea of like, oh, they've destroyed so many ships, there's no mention of, oh, well, Nero did that for a reason. There's literally just, oh, they just decided to blow some Klingons up for a laugh. Yeah, it's really weird. You're right.
It's
that's so strange.
Weird in the movie.
I was playing Star Trek Online when it first came out 10 years ago. And it came out in the wake of this movie.
Boy, did it.
And what's interesting is that, of course, it had to, because it was not originally written. Star Trek Online was not written to have Romulus blowing up in it. But because it's set in the Prime Universe, they had to rewrite the game to fit the plot of Star Trek 2009. And so there's this whole plot about how the Romulus blew up, the Hobus supernova, and what caused that. And they tie it into Thalaron radiation and all this stuff from Nemesis. And Spock's destruction, Spock's death is a big issue in the game. And they got both Zachary Quinto and Leonard Nimoy to do voice acting for the game when it launched. And Nimoy has these like sort of intro little bits that he does for like every time you enter a new sector of the quadrant, Spock comes on and gives you some blather about how it's important, right? and then Zachary Quinto plays, and I shit you not, an emergency medical hologram who appears in the tutorial and basically teaches you how to play the game. And they have since cut virtually his entire thing. I think they made a whole new tutorial because they realized that there's only one emergency hologram and it's not Zachary Quinto. And so they recut him, and I think now he's like, I don't know, some other AI.
Well, that's where the culprit stuff comes in. So when they drop Quinto is when there was the Paramount Viacom split.
Oh.
Paramount gets the movies and CBS gets the TV shows. So since the game is based on the TV shows, they kept that. So then they had to distance themselves from anything that included the movies.
Well, that's all been resolved now, by the way.
Oh yeah,
and this was the problem when we were making the RPG. We couldn't mention anything from the reboots. So the idea that Romulus is going to get destroyed, that's mentioned only in this thing. We can't mention that. There could be no reference to that whatsoever. So, and obviously, I believe there is mention of it in Picard. So again, Picard is another thing on another kind of show over here anyway. So I'm hoping that if they ever get to that kind of stage in the RPG, because Picard has kind of addressed it, we can get back to a stage where we can actually say, oh yeah, Romulus, and then not mention anything else.
Well, I thought licenses have been reconciled now because the Kelvin universe stuff is all showing up in Star Trek Online now.
Like, oh, but that's good then, because again, this is the thing. The first thing to get, I believe, picked up was the animated series managed to actually make some appearance into the RPG stuff, because that stuck into the other stuff as well. But this was the thing. This is the problem with the Kelvinverse stuff. There was lots of stuff that you saw other aspects of Federation life or Federation events that obviously could have happened in the Prime Universe, but you couldn't say, oh, obviously that could happen in the Prime Universe because it's in the film. You can't touch it with a barge pole. So it got to be a bit of a thing, yeah.
I think for a long time, I mean, I've always been confused for years about why Star Trek had this obsession for many years about going backwards in the Star Trek chronology instead of forwards. And so we got Enterprise and Discovery and the Kelvin universe, which again is a rewind. But the Kelvin universe, at least, after three movies, appears to be an experiment that is over. And I think most fans would say it failed, maybe. And I think even the studio has to admit it failed, because if it hadn't, they'd be making a fourth movie by now, right?
Yeah.
But after the death of Yelchin, Anton Yelchin, tragic death, and then also the pretty mediocre response, the ever-declining response to the three films, right? Like everyone seems to like less and less. Although when we get to Beyond, there, I feel like Beyond is at least trying to be Star Trek more than maybe either of the previous two films. But there's no plans, no firm plans, at least, to make another film in that series. And instead, the sequel to Beyond was Discovery. And Discovery's proven, well, CBS clearly loves Star Trek on television again. And they've got more
product. And I have a theory about that.
Yeah, sure.
Well, 2009, which is a lot further away than I want to admit now that I'm past 50.
Yeah.
You know, you had to try to find, from Paramount Viacom's point of view, you had to find a way to monetize Star Trek. Because let's be honest, this more so than any other Trek thing ever done was about the money.
Yeah.
Blatantly, cynically, cruelly. Well, in 2009, what are your options? I mean, Star Trek just doesn't really fit into the TV landscape of 2009. So you've got to make your big dumb action movie out of it.
Yeah.
Well, now here in 2020, now streaming is such a valid option. And what is streaming other than making people pay for niche entertainment that they used to get for free on basic cable? And let's face it, nobody is going to pay for a streaming channel full of big, dumb action movies, because you can still go to the theater and still those. You can get an HBO subscription, watch that on pay cable. But if you want to give people the real Star Trek that's about ideas and emotions, and as Abrams-fied as Discovery can be sometimes, it's getting back to the more intimate, dramatic moments, like when Dr. Boyce first walked into Pike's quarters to talk about the burdens of command. You know, now that there's a viable technological financial model for that type of Star Trek, that's where it is. And I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that I've read a couple of directors, Hollywood directors, talking about how all the stuff that they used to want to do in movies, you now do as a cable series.
Yeah.
You know? You do a 6 or 8 or 10 episode cable series, and that's where the talent goes too.
Yep. Like,
and so I totally agree with you, Chris. And I think that we're seeing that with Star Trek. It reminds me of when the four Marvel shows went to Netflix, and we got like seasons of Daredevil and stuff, and instead of a Daredevil movie, right, we got this long extended where practically every episode was like a Daredevil movie. It was so intelligently scripted and so meticulously written, and everything kind of connected to everything else. And it was clearly just a huge amount of labor went into the production of that show. And that would never make it in a Hollywood film now, because every superhero movie has to be, you know, goddamn Iron Man or Avengers, whatever. And there's just no room for that kind of show. But this is good, right? This is ultimately good, because as Jim pointed out, Star Trek is just kind of not well suited to movies. It's really a creature of television.
Also, we should also mention, though, that the often touted Quentin Tarantino Star Trek films. I mean, what the hell they're going to be if it ever takes off? I have no clue at all. And I fear, as much as I love Tarantino, the idea of mixing those two together.
We were talking about that pre-show. My feeling is it will be very much 60s Trek. It'll be about 4 or 5 hours long, and we will get at least one jaw-dropping scene of insane violence at some point. It may be the last 20 minutes of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but at some point the styrofoamy Enterprise will get covered in somebody's blood.
Yeah. All right. Anybody else? Otherwise, we'll wrap it up. We've been going over an hour.
One quick point.
Jim, yes.
So we kind of hit all my sort of the bad and the ugly. I'm going to talk about the good. I'm going to leave on a high note.
Okay.
2009, well, 1 year in the Barack Obama presidency. It feels like ages ago. But the one thing I really liked about rewatching this movie is that the cast is diverse. Yes, the main cast is still the white people that come from the TV show. But just all the roles that could have been played by white people. Tyler Perry is there. Farron Terra is there as Captain Rabot. Like, just, and not even just supporting cast members, but like extras who are flying, you know, shuttlecraft. The guy who flies a shuttlecraft 37 is a black man. We don't know anything about him, but we just, it finally feels like Kirk has a line in the original series Trek.
Yep.
He calls the Enterprise the United Old Ship. And it finally feels like with the 2009 Star Trek, we are getting that United Old Ship.
Yeah.
Well, yes, there's more alien prosthetics in the background, but there's also more color in the background in terms of human beings who live on this planet being represented on in a movie. And I think that's a refreshing change of pace.
It reminds me of that scene that you always call out in the original motion picture when Kirk is talking to the amphitheater full of crew. Mm-hmm. And it's a diverse group of crew. Like, it looks like a little bit of everybody from Earth.
Yeah, the only bit obviously is the Chekhov accent joke. Like, it kind of counteracts that, but like going, hey, we can understand, we've got a universal translator that can understand so many being languages. We cannot understand the Russian accent though.
This film is filled, it's anxiety over other Star Trek movies is so goddamn obvious, and it's just sad. Like the like creatures that Nero has to drop into Pike's mouth is such an obvious callback to Star Trek 2. The apple is Star Trek 2.
You're assuming that anybody who made this film actually gave a shit, and I think you're giving it way too much credit. It's a bunch of people aping, copying things that they've heard about third hand from other Star Trek movies, and they really don't give a damn because they think that as long as they keep repeating enough stuff from the previous iterations, we'll pay to go see it. I don't think anybody attached to this film gave a shit about anything other than the money. I think there was no anxiety. I think there was a hell of a lot of cynicism and basically just sticking a $150 million middle finger in the face of the audience.
I say the creatures is a weird thing at all because the creatures don't do anything. They're literally there. Okay, there's some creatures. Hey, remember this bit in Star Trek 2 with the creatures? That was really scary, wasn't it? Okay, yeah, bunk some creatures in that, be fine. At least in Star Trek 2, they had a reason because they controlled the crew members.
Yeah.
Here it's just like, well, we'll just have them squiggle around a bit, and it's like, do they come back? Does he kind of keel over dead for half an hour later? No, they're just there to have a bit of a laugh. That's it. There's nothing to it.
Well,
I tried to end on a high note.
Fashion concept.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen.
Okay. One more thing, because I mentioned it again in the notes. Let's also mention the fact that Sigourney Weaver. God, my God. I've got completely blank now. The girl from Beetlejuice is Spock's mum. And how old everybody now must feel because it's like, oh my God, what? She's Spock's mum? What's going on? This is madness. So yes, that's terrible.
Yeah, the real pain is part of the generation that had a huge crush on Winona Ryder from Beetlejuice, and now she's that girl that was in Beetlejuice. She doesn't have a name anymore.
I had that moment when Star Trek Superman Returns came out, and Superman and Lois Lane were younger than me when the film was coming out. I'm like, that's not okay.
Yeah.
I'm not okay with his age.
It's like Marissa Tomei is Aunt May. I mean, what's that about? Yeah.
Jim, you brought up Superman earlier. Have you ever read Abrams' Superman scripts?
Oh, yes. They're awful.
Kryptonian Kung Fu. We'll just leave it at that. Kryptonian Kung Fu. We started with Turkish Kung Fu. Let's end with Kryptonian Kung Fu.
There you go.
When we come back in 1 week, we will be looking at what I personally believe is the worst Star Trek movie ever made.
Preach it, Jason.
And Jim, you wrote a long examination about the way that Star Trek Into Darkness comments on and tries to reuse Star Trek II. Is that available anywhere?
I don't have a copy of it. I was, due to complications at work, I was forced to give up my Facebook, and it was written on my Facebook page.
Yeah.
But it was me coming out of the movie theater trying to wrap up my head around what I had just seen and trying to justify the feelings I was having.
Well, the rumor that I had heard before and around this movie, and you know, we're just sort of, I'm asking a question here, is I had heard that the character of Khan was not Khan for much of the movie. That it was originally a different villain that they essentially retconned into being Khan. Is that true?
So originally what happened was they're coming out of this movie. They're already thinking what they're going to do for the next movie. They thought about doing a bumper at the end of the credits where you saw the Botany Bay floating in space, right? Okay. And they thought they'd do a Marvel thing. And then they decided, no, we don't want to nail ourselves into that. And then they came up with the idea of, well, let's hire the guy from Sherlock. Let's hire him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then because of contract negotiations, he can't make it. He falls out of production. But there was this four-year-long wait period between the films. And they start coming out with a tie-in comic book. And this is where the comic book trips up the show, because the very first two issues, they do a remix of Where No Man Has Gone Before, the episode Gary Mitchell's in.
Yeah.
And because of that, they wanted to keep that comic book in continuity, which is so silly when I say it out loud. They wanted to keep the comic book in continuity. But they decided, well, let's just make him Khan when he became available 4 years later. And that's where we start building this mystery box. Oh, it's not Khan. It's not Khan. And we'll give him a different name that was used in one of the original scripts of Space Seed before it became Khan.
I see.
What was his name? Because I cannot remember what they called him.
It was Erickson.
I knew it was something like that. Something very unassuming. Yeah, yeah. And then we go, yeah, that's horseshit. You're telling me the big bad guy is going to be called Erickson. It's like, well, that's it's almost as bad as the Spectre thing. Where this guy's not going to be Blofeld. It's not going to be Blofeld. He's just a ski instructor. It's like, yeah, right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, gang. Well, we will be back, and we are almost done. We've got, we just have Into Darkness and the Star Trek Beyond. And then we'll have walked through all of the Star Trek films. Back next week.